Hi everyone, before we begin today's episode, we wanted to provide a disclaimer. We recorded our conversation with Leila Saad prior to the death of George Floyd and everything that has happened since. Considering the current political climate, we think it's more important than ever to have these conversations about white supremacy and the actions that we need to take. Racism is our history and the unfortunate reality of our present-day society. However, it doesn't have to be our future. Please listen carefully to what Leila has to say. Note the moments where you feel uncomfortable. That means you are paying attention. We hope that this episode will empower you to take action as we continue on the fight against white supremacy. It is our civic duty. How do we navigate spaces in which we can have access to some privileges but not others? How can anyone claim their identity without first recognizing their entitlement? Today, we will do a deep dive on these topics with Leila Saad. She is an esteemed writer, speaker, and podcast host. You may recognize her voice from her viral open letter, "I Need to Talk to Spiritual White Women About White Supremacy," or her 28-day Instagram challenge, hashtag me and white supremacy, where she has led exercises and workshops to address one's complicity to white supremacy.
A good ally isn't focused on whether they're looking like a good ally. They're focused on showing up in allyship to people of color and not wondering about, am I going to be seen? Am I going to be rewarded? Anti-racism work is taking a deep dive within first, really uncovering how you perpetuate white supremacy and then creating change from within. Some ways that people with white privilege feel like they're helping black people and people of color are through acts that come across as white saviorism. Movies like The Blind Side, The Help, The Great Wall really perpetuate white saviorist narratives. The example of The Great Wall, we have this story that's set in China, but the hero of the day is Matt Damon.
I'll give you the shot.
This is mainstream media, and the narratives that we are seeing is it doesn't matter what culture it is, it doesn't matter where these people come from, it's white people who are going to swoop in and save the day.
Now that challenge has turned into a New York Times best-selling book, Me and White Supremacy, providing the tools to go inwards as you begin to unpack how you benefit from and further white supremacy. It's not only for white people, by the way. The exercises are formatted so that anyone who benefits from white privilege can do the work as well. Outside of the book, Leila is the host of the Good Ancestor podcast, where she facilitates conversations on the intersection of race, feminism, identity, spirituality, and leadership to foster social change. I am incredibly excited to have her on my show today.
We're all, as parents, really worried about having conversations with our kids about race because we don't want them to be jaded. We don't want them to have fear around the conversation. We don't want them to feel guilt or shame. But the longer we leave it, the more of a disservice we do to them because we're not equipping them from an early age to be able to think critically about what the world is and how it's set up.
Thank you so much, Leila, for coming on my show. I am so excited and I have so many questions for you.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So, Me and White Supremacy started off as an Instagram challenge where you led these exercises for people to address their white privilege, right? And the ways in which they contribute to white supremacy. And then you went viral and you ended up creating a free workbook that was downloaded by hundreds of thousands of people. And now you have this wonderful, amazing book, which is New York Times bestseller, Me and White Supremacy. So for our listeners who may be new to your work, can you talk about the origins of Me and White Supremacy and how has it evolved with each stage?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so Me and White Supremacy is actually my debut book. But as you've, you know, quite beautifully laid out there, the book is not where it started. That where it started was with the Instagram challenge in the summer of 2018. And the origin for how that conversation got started and why I launched that challenge was I had been talking about racism, anti-racism, and white supremacy for about almost a year prior to that. I'd started doing so in the summer of 2017 when the Unite the Right rally happened in Charlottesville, Virginia. You probably remember, you know, the images, seeing the men marching in the streets with the torches, and they were screaming the racial slurs. And it just, I remember seeing it on the news and it, you know, the images of it, and it just really, it triggered me very, very deeply. And so I was drawn to write an article. It was an open letter to the people who were in my community at the time. So at the time, I was actually a life coach. I was a business coach. I wasn't doing anti-racism work at all. But I was becoming very aware in the ways in which white supremacy and white privilege was playing out in this area of personal growth and spirituality and personal development. And so I wrote a letter at the time, and it was called I Need to Talk to Spiritual White Women About White Supremacy. And I was just addressing it, like I said, to the people in my community, my peers, my clients, you know, my followers. And I had a very small following at the time, and I didn't expect it to go much further than the people I was speaking to. But the complete opposite happened, and that letter went very, very viral with hundreds of thousands of people reading it, and it really initiated me into a public conversation about white supremacy. So over the course of the year, I was having conversations online every day with people about, you know, whiteness and white supremacy and white privilege and what does it mean. And the conversations were really hard to have because I wasn't talking to the people who identified with the men who were marching in Charlottesville. I was actually talking to the people who really considered themselves not racist. I was speaking to the people who considered themselves spiritual, liberal, progressive, you know, they voted for Obama, you know, they have black friends, right? Like they were like, this doesn't apply to us. So why are you accusing us of this? And they really felt like, especially for white women, they really felt like when you talk about race, you're dividing our fight against patriarchy and sexism. Like, put that aside and let's deal with our issues under gender, and then maybe later we can deal with this other thing. But so that's why it was causing quite a commotion. And what I'd noticed, though, is that over the course of that year, as I was repeatedly having conversations with people about white supremacy, that they became more open to the conversation. Because they went from an understanding of racism, that racism is just what bad people do, it's only mean individuals, to really understand, no, white privilege exists whether you want it to or not. White supremacy is a system that we're all conditioned into. They became much more comfortable with the terms and the concepts. And so one night, it was almost a year later, I was lying in bed and just thinking about how much easier it was for me as a black woman speaking every day to white people about white supremacy, how it had become a little bit easier. It wasn't a daily fight. And so I posed myself the question, what have they learned about themselves and white supremacy that makes it easier? I wonder what they would say about what they've learned. And so I grabbed my phone and started to write what I thought was going to be a single Instagram post asking that question. But then I thought, well, what is white supremacy? You know, I'm asking them, what have they learned about themselves and white supremacy? But what is white supremacy? And I began to list out these different ways that I had observed white supremacy shows up. And they became these prompts that are in the workbook, they became, I had dozens of them. They, you know, it's color blindness, it's white fragility, it's tone policing, it's white feminism, it's white centering. Just so many of these prompts came through. And I realized this is not just a single Instagram post. This is some sort of challenge or journey or something. And so that night I just put it up on my Instagram page and I said, hey, tomorrow we're going to go through this 28-day journey for you to explore and understand and share what you've learned about yourself and white supremacy, what you understand about white privilege and your complicity in the system. You know, join me tomorrow. And that was it. Went to sleep, woke up the next day and thought, oh, what have I done? is this a good idea? You know, all kinds of thoughts. But I put it out onto the internet. So I thought, okay, let's begin. So we started that day with day one, white privilege. And from that very first day, I could tell that something really important was happening because people were journaling. So I asked the question, what have you learned about you and white privilege? And I explained what is white privilege. And I explained some ways in which it shows up. And then I shared some sort of like reflective journaling questions for them to think about. But then it ended with, okay, so now tell me, how do you understand your white privilege? What do you understand about how white privilege shows up in your personal life, not in other people's lives, but in your own? And people were journaling under each post, really, you know, digging deep, really sharing the ugly stuff, right? The stuff that nobody wants to really say. And so I realized very, very quickly that this was something bigger than just a 28-day challenge. And so I was very mindful to lay each day, you know, from day one to day two to day three, very much making sure that the sequence made sense, that each day was building upon the last day's learnings. And so we journeyed together in this big experiment with thousands of people taking part. I had about 19,000 followers when we started the challenge, and that number more than doubled by the time we finished a month later. And when we finished, I knew that couldn't be the end of it. I knew it had to, such deep work had taken place in that journey that it needed to be turned into a book. And so I spent some time writing it. And so at the end of that year, the end of 2018, published it as a PDF workbook, you know, taking that same 28-day process, those same days, but really expanding more upon each of the days. What does it mean? What does white centering mean? What does color blindness mean? And I published that for free, and that book went viral. And like you said, within the space of 6 months, 100,000 people had downloaded it. In fact, within a month is when I started hearing from very big traditional publishers. You know, have you thought about publishing this as a book? And I thought, no, I thought that was just, it was going to be it. I put it out as a workbook and that's it, you know. But what made me want to turn it into a hardcover book that people could hold in their hands and an audiobook as well that people could listen to was that the challenge went from something that I thought was just going to be individuals just doing it in their homes, you know, people who were just individually curious about doing this work, to people were using the PDF workbook itself in companies, in nonprofits, in churches, in spaces and places, you know, universities, people using it as a curriculum. Just places I could not have imagined. And so I realized, again, like this work is bigger than just a PDF workbook. It needs to be made as accessible as possible. It needs to go as wide as possible because it's offering a process which hasn't been necessarily there before. There are really amazing books on anti-racism work that lay out history, that lay out memoirs, you know, just incredible books that I recommend in the back of Me and White Supremacy. But this was very much a book that you do and not just a book that you read. And for people who were like, what do I do next? Like, I read the book, I got the information, but what am I supposed to do? This was like, here, go do this book, go dig deep inside of yourself and go learn about and uncover for yourself how you are involved in white supremacy.
Do you think, Leila, this book resonated because of it being a workbook, something that people can do rather than just read and put it away?
I think that was definitely part of it, because people hear again and again, go do the work, go do the work. And they're like, what does that mean? I don't know what that means. And it's funny because with my work and because of the way that I talk about the work and how direct it is, people feel both. People always say, like, I'm both scared and excited to do this book, right? Because I'm excited because it's giving me something. It's giving me, like you said, like something that I can do. It's actionable. But I'm also scared because I'm going to have to really learn things about myself that I didn't know, that I've been avoiding or that have been hidden from me. And that's going to put me in a place of great discomfort. But I think, yeah, I think people are like, this is a way in which I personally can do the work.
Talking about the book, at the beginning of the book, you state that you do this work because you were called to do it and you answered that call. Does this tie to your desire, in your words, to be a good ancestor?
Yes, yeah, because I'll tell you something, this work isn't easy. And for anybody who is in anti-racism work or anti-oppression work, you know that. You know, I'm a Black Muslim woman. And what white supremacy says about me is my Blackness makes me not a whole human being. And my religion makes me a threat, a terrorist, right? So I'm every day having conversations with people who do not know that that is what they believe. And I say do not know because there's, you know, I was saying earlier about how the people who I'm talking to often see themselves as, I'm not racist. I don't know why you're talking to me. Go talk to those people. What they don't realize is those same messages that those people, quote unquote, have received, you have received them too. They're just not consciously at the front of your mind. The media is all the time driving home messages around what being Black and being brown or being Muslim means. History has given us a context of enslavement, colonization, land theft, you know, racist laws, and so on and so forth. That doesn't go away just because we're in the 21st century. There has never been a reckoning with that history. There has never been a real like reparation or an accounting of what has happened. And so it's like, let's just carry on it because the laws changed. So that means everything's changed and now we don't have to worry about racism. But we can change all the laws that we want, but if we don't change the fact that the system is still rigged in the favor of white privilege, and it doesn't change the fact that psychologically there's still a belief in superiority and supremacy, things to continue to be the same. It will just play out in different ways. Nobody's now going to colonize land. Nobody's, you know, it's not that tactic, but it's other tactics that are more subtle, that affect Black and brown people in very subtle ways, but in their everyday lives where, you know, so we give an example of being in the workplace, you know, Black and brown people who are in workplaces where they are the only or one of the onlys, right, are expected not to, you know, speak up if something racist happens, not to like make a fuss, don't be so angry, right? Don't like make yourself small. And also, you know, when we look at things like women will often say, especially white women will say, look at the gender pay gap, but also look at the gender pay gap according to race, right? So to come back to your question around, like, is this your calling? It, for me, it has to be because this isn't by choice. I was doing really safe work where I was a life coach and a business coach, and I didn't talk about, you know, justice or race or anything like that. And the minute that I started to do so, things got really, really hard. One of the things that I talk about in the book is I lost one of my best friends of many, many years who was a white woman. And that was because when I began talking about race, she disappeared herself from my life, from our friendship.
Why do you think that happened?
In retrospect now, I understand that it must have been too much for her. She was somebody who had never, in our conversations with each other, we had never, ever, ever talked about race. And she was British, and the British are not used to having conversations about race in a very direct way. They will point their finger at the Americans and say, they're the racists. We're not racist, right? And so I think she didn't know what to do, or And her fragility must have been triggered because I'm talking to all white people, and she must have thought, does she mean me as well? Like, is she including me in that? And she didn't have the ability to be able to have that conversation with me. In our final conversation with each other, I said, look, the reason I need to end our friendship is because you've shown up for me in all other areas of my life. But when I started talking about race, you practically disappeared. And I just need to understand why. And she said, well, because, you know, I just noticed that, you know, you have other Black women who are being there for you. So I didn't really feel like you needed me.
Wow. So what advice do you have for people of color as they navigate through these difficult dynamics in friendships with white people? How do they approach this topic?
Yeah. So, I mean, I can speak from the perspective of friends who I have who are Black women. And what they have said is I'll tell you about one of my best friends, actually, who's a Black Dutch woman, Surinamese. And she said for her, the standard for her friendships with white people has now become, have you done me in white supremacy? Because in order for us to be friends and me to feel that you understand what I am experiencing in my life as a Black woman, and for you to be able to show up for me in ways that, first of all, don't cause harm without you realizing it, but also that when harm is coming my way, that you're able to show up for me and stand up for me, you need to be able to understand what white supremacy is and how it shows up in your life. If you're not willing to do the work, that means that I'm not important to you.
So, Leila, when we talk about white supremacy, I think one of the reasons why it's such a huge trigger for many people is because they equate it to it being bad, right? So if you're racist, you're bad. If you are white supremacist, you're bad. Interestingly enough, your books gives a different perspective on whether it's good or bad. You don't necessarily call it as bad. You, in fact, assume that people who may not be bad people can be white supremacists or racists. And that's the distinction that you draw. And that's something that you talk about in your book as well. How did you get to that conclusion? And do you think that makes it easier for people to navigate this space?
Well, I would say, I'm not the first person to ever say that, right? And so if you study the work of people throughout history who have done racial justice work, they really make it clear. White supremacy is a system. It's an intentionally created system that is designed to grant power and privilege to certain people. And so, you know, I talk about in the book the fact that actually different races is not a thing. We're actually only one human race. Black people and white people and brown people, we're not biologically different. We're all actually biologically the same. However, race as a social construct is very real. And what that means is race has been constructed. The idea that there are different races and that those different races have different attributes, right? So if you're white, it means you're this. If you're black, it means you're this. So I'll use the example of just white and black, right? One of the, constructs about being black, as which this construct has come from white people, right? This construct, and not white people today, but white people, you know, centuries ago, especially in America, to justify enslavement, right? The construct is that black people are not entire human beings. There's something animalistic about blackness. There's something biologically inferior in the brain, in the body. We're more seen as brutes and animals rather than human beings, which then gives justification for why all the things that have happened to black people have happened. Because if you're not a whole human being, you're not seeing white people doing it to white people. You're seeing white people doing it to black people. And the justification is, well, they're not really human. They're really part animal, part human. So that's what makes it okay to do that.
It's happening even now.
Of course, because it didn't go away. It just went underground and it shows up in different ways. And so white supremacy is a system that is designed to give power and privilege to white people over people of other races. It to justify things like what I've just talked about is to justify even today, if we look at, I know in America, there's a lot of segregation. And when there's schools, there are like schools where there's predominantly white kids, and then there's schools where there's black kids and kids of color. And the kind of resources that go to those different schools, right? Who gets more resources? Who gets more? Yeah, just who's being given more, right? And that comes down to, well, it's because we don't really believe that they deserve the same.
But Leila, do you think that we as people of color unconsciously facilitate white supremacy by imitating white lifestyle, preferring neighborhoods that are predominantly white, preferring schools that are predominantly white? And people like me also complain that there isn't as much diversity in these spaces. For instance, the curriculum that's taught at our kids' schools has a clear white bias.
I think the thing to remember here is people, like I was saying earlier on, Black people and people of color, Indigenous people, are doing what they can to survive in a system that isn't built for them. So yes, we have to participate in it only because collectively Black and brown people don't hold enough power to make it otherwise.
Yeah, that makes sense. But how do we change that, Leila? Do you think the onus should just be on white people to do it? Or do you think Black, Indigenous and people of color hold some responsibility as well?
Here's what I believe. White supremacy is a system that was created by white people, and it is specifically designed to benefit white people. It cannot be dismantled by Black and brown people because we don't own it. We can do things like what I do, educate white people and people with white privilege. We can do what activists do, right? Which is to get out on the streets, which is to lobby, which is to, you know, do all of those things. But those are, and that's, many Black and brown people are doing that, but we are limited to the extent that white people will release power. And so oftentimes, I remember when I was speaking about when I first started talking about racism in the early days, and something that I would hear a lot from white women would be, look, if you would just like talk about this in a nicer way, then maybe we would help you with your cause, right? They saw it as this cause that's a problem for Black and brown people that they didn't create, they don't benefit from, it has nothing to do with them. It's unfortunate that it happens, but it really has nothing to do with them. Not realizing we didn't create it. We are on the receiving end of it. We are doing what we can to survive within it. It only changes when white people collectively decide to create change. That is the only way that it actually changes. And so throughout history, you have, you know, civil rights movements and other movements that are led around the world by Black and brown people against what white supremacy does. There's still going to be a limit on what can be done until white people release power. And what we've seen is so many people have had to give their lives, right? We've just recently had Malcolm X's birthday, 95th birthday, right? How many leaders who were doing this really important work eventually ended up losing their lives to it, and still things are the same. So yes, everybody, you know, we all need to get free together, but ultimately nothing changes until white people collectively do the work.
And talking about how you bring forth these issues, you just mentioned that there was this one woman who said that if you did it nicely, I've been reading your book, and yes, you are direct and you don't sugarcoat, but you bring forth these issues in such a compassionate way. And you encourage readers to prioritize self-care while being honest. And so I'm shocked that if somebody, after reading your book or doing your workbook, would even remotely think that it's not done in a compassionate manner and it's not done nicely, although I think the word nicely itself is problematic. Why are we called out on our emotions and white people aren't?
So I think people sometimes, I've had this feedback, this response, that when people hear me talk, they're surprised at how I talk, because they expect me to be this like raging, aggressive, angry Black woman, right? And they're like, oh, you're not. And that was what I was expecting, and you're not it. And it's because Blackness already has a tone in the eyes of white people. And that comes from racial stereotypes of Black people. The angry Black woman trope, the stereotype, is one of those unconsciously planted beliefs, right, that people have in the back of their minds about Black people, about Black women. And also there is a, on the, you know, you were asking, why don't white people have that same, like, why aren't they painted with that same brush? I think that there's a trope that white women have, which is that they are innocent and pure and well-meaning.
That's a convenient trope to have, Leila.
It's a very nice trope to have, but it's also super disempowering. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, if that was a trope about me, I'd be like, oh, you know, what if I'm not, you know? So we all get these stereotypes about us, but some stereotypes are quote-unquote negative and some are quote-unquote positive, right? And so I always say Blackness has a tone and whiteness has a different tone.
But those tones are human made.
Exactly. They're not real. They're socially constructed, and not socially constructed by all of us together, but socially constructed through what's called the white gaze, which is how whiteness views all of us and says, this is how you are and this is how you are, right? So in the book, on the page on the day on racist stereotypes, we break down, like, if you're of Latinx heritage, what are some of the stereotypes that are given about you, right? So Latina women are often called spicy, or, you know, names like that. Or if you're, let's say, Japanese, maybe you're seen as submissive or subdued. If you're Arab, maybe you're seen as oppressed and need to be rescued, right? These tropes come from whiteness.
You know, it's interesting you bring up Arab trope. I would have thought more aggressive.
That's one as well. But I meant from the women's perspective. So often Arab women are seen as, oh, you wear the hijab, you know, let me liberate you.
They've been doing that for quite some time. They've tried to liberate Afghanistan. They tried doing that with Iraq. Unfortunately, the pretext of colonialism has changed. The conversation or the narrative has changed to democracy now.
You know, somebody who I think that you would really love to have a conversation with, and who I want to recommend to everyone to go check out this report. So I've just interviewed an amazing woman called Maitha Al-Hassan, and she's a Syrian-American journalist and historian. And she put together this report called Haq and Hollywood. And it's about the history of, in the media and in pop culture, of Arab and Muslim tropes and stereotypes. So things that you see in the movies, on TV, and in the media over time, of how Arabs and Muslims, well, sorry, Muslims specifically, have been portrayed over time. And it's really interesting, because even as a Muslim myself, I'm like, oh, I never realized. One of the tropes of Muslims is the bumbling fool, the person who, you know, is very like, so I'll give you the example of like Aladdin, Jasmine's father. If you remember him in the 1992 Disney movie, he was very much like, oh, I'm a sultan of a country, but I don't really know what's going on. You know, that is, she lays out different ways in which that trope has been used in different pop culture moments. And so I bring this up because one of the things that especially people who are white, but actually all of us, don't realize is the ways in which we are conditioned into these beliefs through the media and through TV and films and the news. And we have to, like, actually do the work of picking apart what the story is that we're being told versus what's the reality.
So here's the thing. I don't see Hollywood as liberal, especially in its depiction of diversity. Look at all the tropes, Muslim tropes. We have Muslim terrorists. We have Black and brown gangsters. And I see white complicity in it again, because white actors, white writers, they don't protest. But at the same time, I see Black people, people of color, taking up those roles, which to me is problematic, no?
And what I'll say to that, though, again, is, you know, and I'll give you this example. So you were talking about movies. I'm going to talk about the publishing world. The publishing world is an extremely white space, as is every other institutional space, right? And we, people who are Black and brown, do not get publishing deals as much as our white counterparts. And the type of deals that we get are not the same as our white counterparts. And so throughout history, in different realms, such as the publishing world, such as in the media, in let's say the movie industry, TV, people have basically like two choices. You either take what's being given to you, right? Or you go and make your own, and it's not going to get the same support and resources and accolades as that of what dominant culture is getting, but at least you get to have full ownership and get to have the roles and the stories that you want. Now, things are changing in that we are seeing, you know, we can't say that now 2020 is the same as 2010 in terms of what we're able to see out there. And that's from, I think there's a point at which it becomes like we can't continue with this as it was, but it's still very, very slow moving. And this is where it's really important to bring it back to the importance of white people doing the work so that they can show up in the practice of allyship. This is really where it's important for people who are white to understand, oh, my peer or my team member is not going to get the same opportunities as me. It's really up to me to stand with them to ensure that they get this, 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 this. In the same way that we see it when women talk about we need men to stand with us to say she should get paid the same as me.
Yeah, but we are seeing, at least in terms of Muslim representation, we are seeing sort of watershed moment.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, and that's what I was saying. We are seeing the change, but it also is really dependent on the people around standing with you. Because you could be seeing the change, and I'll give you the example of, again, with the publishing world, we're seeing so many more books now that are written by Black and brown people. There's a real thirst and a real want for stories, you know, diverse, quote unquote, authors, right? It doesn't mean that behind the scenes they're being treated the same as the white authors.
Exactly. Laird, are you concerned about tokenism? Because this can lead to tokenism as well, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is where, so tokenism happens where people understand we need, as I said, quote unquote, diversity, but and they understand, maybe they now have a kind of understanding of it's racist not to have diversity, and I don't want to be racist.
Right? Exactly.
So we don't want to be a racist organization. We don't want to be accused of that. We want to be doing the right thing. So let's bring in some people of color, some Black people, right? So they bring them in, but they have done no work to interrogate their own unconscious racist thoughts and beliefs and behaviors. And so they bring people in and they continue to racially aggress, not realizing that that's what they're doing. So let's say they bring in, we need to hire more Black and brown people. However, we're not addressing the fact that we're paying them less. We're not addressing the fact that we don't actually support them into getting into positions of leadership.
We don't give them meaty roles.
We don't get them meaty roles. In team meetings, we second guess them. We speak over them, right? So you can make something look diverse very easily. That is just marketing. That is just like a few simple decisions. Okay, we'll hire a few more in. But nothing changed inside. And now those people are in organizations and in spaces where they are expected to represent their entire race. Any question that's about anything to do with diversity or being a person of color, or being a Black person, they are expected to speak on it. And when something happens to them where someone has done something racist, you know, it's not addressed properly.
Leah, I want to switch gears a bit and talk about your mother, because you mentioned how your mom raised you to be exceptional, to outshine your white peers in your studies. And your parents immigrated. They immigrated from Zanzibar, now called Tanzania, and to Kenya, and then to UK, where you and your brothers were raised before moving to Qatar. You moved to Qatar. Your brothers are still in UK, right?
Yes. So my mom is from Zanzibar. My dad is from Kenya. They emigrated to Wales, which is where they met. And they had me and my brothers, and we lived in Wales. And then we lived in Wales, and we lived in Tanzania. Then we lived in England. And then we moved to Qatar. And then my brothers, when they went, so we all went to university in the UK, but when I finished my degree, I moved back here. When they finished their degrees, they stayed there. Yeah, so my parents were still here. They, when we moved out here initially, we were only going to be here for maybe 3 years, and then we were all going to move back to the UK for me to do my degree. And when the time came, my parents were like, we want to stay here, so you go do your degree. And the reason why we moved out here, partly because my father, who works in the oil and gas industry, was offered a job out here. And he's always like, he's one of those people that when he's given a new opportunity that stretches him in a way that he hasn't been stretched before, he always takes it. But also they wanted to move out to the Middle East because my grandmother, who was my only surviving grandparent at the time, had moved from Zanzibar to Oman, and they wanted to be closer to her as she was in the later years of her life. And then they also, because we're Muslim, they wanted us to grow up in a Muslim environment. We'd never lived in a Muslim environment before. That's why we moved out here. The reason I moved back here was I struggled a lot in my university years with depression and anxiety. I'm a third culture kid, right? As many of the immigrants who are listening to this are. And that means, you know, I grew up in a culture that wasn't the culture of my parents. I really didn't know who I was or how to define my identity. And going back to the UK for my degree really messed with me because it was like people didn't really see me as British, but I was British, but I didn't know what that meant. And I knew I was different to everyone else, but I didn't know that was good enough. And so I struggled with depression and anxiety in my degree. And so I moved home with the intention to just be here for a year and then to go back to the UK. And I just never went back. I found it very difficult living in the UK. I found it difficult not living in a Muslim country. I found it difficult always being the odd one out, you know, never feeling like, because the thing with living here is everyone is different. So that's why I stayed back here. And then after I got married and had kids, you know, it was important for me to have kids that were also growing up in a Muslim country.
This is such an important perspective, Leila, because as an immigrant mother, I am aware of systemic or societal injustices that are set in place for my kids, probably, right? And I am not discounting my privilege. And I am so glad that when I was reading your book, the way you lay out your privileges, they are so beautifully laid out. And you recognize those. And I recognize my privileges as well. But what I can do for my kids as I see them grow in a country that's not predominantly Muslim is to encourage them to do whatever they can in the best manner to overcome those biases, right? But it is a scary process, and I do worry about my kids. What advice, if any, do you have for immigrants who are raising their kids in countries that are not predominantly Muslim or Black or Brown? How to raise them in a manner where we don't make them skeptical or jaded, encourage them to assume and accept their identity in the best possible fashion they can?
Yeah, so definitely my kids are privileged in that they've never had to experience being the odd one out, ever. That's a foreign concept to them. And they are third culture kids of third culture parents, because my husband's also a third culture kid. So they don't know what that experience is. But as somebody who, you know, like I laid out all the different countries that I've lived in, I know that my kids could grow up to live anywhere in the world. And so it's always been important for me to talk to them about race. That's always been important. I don't take it for granted to say, oh, because we live here and it's multicultural, so we don't have to worry. At the end of the day, my kids are Black, and anti-Blackness is a global phenomenon, and it's not just restricted to certain countries. It's everywhere. But also, I want them to understand that when other people are, when they witness other people experiencing racism or any kind of discrimination, that it's their responsibility to say something. And so I teach them from the perspective of, I want them to understand, in the same way that my book lays out the reality, this is how the world is structured. You need to understand that this is how the world is structured. And you also need to understand that it's not the reality. It's their misunderstanding that we are inferior. It's not the truth. And I have a course that I teach on parenting and white supremacy, although it is actually for parents who have white privilege. But I think the same applies to all of us, which is that we're all, as parents, really worried about having conversations with our kids about race because we don't want them to be jaded. We don't want them to have fear around the conversation. We don't want them to feel guilt or shame. But the longer we leave it, the more of a disservice we do to them, because we're not equipping them from an early age to be able to think critically about what the world is and how it's set up. And one of the things that I always say to people who are white is, one of the reasons why you have so much white fragility is that your parents were unable to have conversations with you from an early age about these issues. And so you're only having them now. And that scared part of your brain that's going, but this is not how the world is, this is not what I was taught, is freaking out. Whereas if you have those conversations when you're young, and when we're young, we're still learning, our brains are still being formed, and our understanding of the world is still in flex, right? It's still being formed. Young people can understand this in a way that doesn't have fear or shame attached to it. So I think as parents, it's our job to do our work, regardless of race, right? To do our work to understand what white supremacy is, how it functions, what it means. So then we can have conversations with our children in a way where we're equipping them with the understanding, and we're also reinforcing to them that this is not, just because it's what the world is doesn't mean it's what the reality is.
Do you think this book is also for children, if a child was to read it, say a teenager, maybe a 12 or a 13-year-old?
So this book isn't, but I'm actually working on the young readers edition.
Oh, wonderful. So when is that coming out?
TBD, especially with COVID-19 skewing everybody's plans, right? I was supposed to be deep in writing mode right now, but with my kids home and all plans changed, things have shifted a bit, but it is definitely coming. I am contracted for it, and I'm really excited about it because, like I was saying, kids are actually more open to this conversation than adults are. They're probably already having these conversations in some way at this age that their parents didn't at that age. Their parents were taught, we don't see color.
Oh my God, that's such a bullshit line. Oh my God. It just triggers me to the point where I'm like, you should see color.
Well, you do see color. That's the thing. It's not you should, you do see color. You do see color. You've just been taught that it's the correct thing to say is that I don't see color, that's what being anti-racist means.
I never thought of it like that. I thought maybe they really meant it.
No. They see it that they've just been taught that this is the correct way to be anti-racist, is to say I don't see color, and then to attempt as best as possible to act from that place. But you can't act from that place if you haven't addressed the ways in which white supremacy has conditioned you to believe the complete opposite, which is that you do see color and that you see certain people of certain colors in a certain way. That needs to be undone. And when we say we don't see color as well, one of the things that bothers me about it is, oh, you think that that's, you're being kind when you say that. You think that that's the kind and right thing to say. But actually what you're saying to me is you don't see the way that the color of my skin affects how I'm treated in the world.
Exactly. So Leila, you've done so many interviews about your work, this book, and the reality of white supremacy. How do you prioritize self-care?
Yeah, I'm actually on a social media break at the minute. I started yesterday. I'm off for 11 days. Yeah, I'm off for 11 days because, like, you know, we're in this global pandemic, and just before we were all sent to our homes and told not to come out, I had just done two international book tours. So
yeah, it was like, I was like, okay, finish the book tour. It's going to go home now. I'm going to go to the spa and the museum and the library and do all of these things. And it was like, no, there's a global pandemic that's happening. And so I never took a moment there to be able to rest because I was suddenly a homeschool teacher. right. But self-care is very important to me. You mentioned in the book that I talk about it even for the people who are doing this work. I say you have to prioritize your self-care. The reason being is that anti-racism work is lifelong work. And if you treat it like it's a sprint instead of a marathon, then you're going to burn out really, really quickly. And so I know it's the same for me. In order for me to show up in my work the way that I want to show up, like you said, I'm direct, but I'm also compassionate. In order for me to be able to be from that place, I have to have a very full and overflowing cup. And so some of the things that are very important to me are boundaries. You know, I'm very clear on what I will and won't do, how I will and won't show up. You know, right before we had this conversation, I'd ask, could you send me the list of questions that you're planning on asking, or at least let me know, you know, what the speaking topics are, because that then lets me know if there's something on there and I'm like, no, I'm not going to talk about that, then I can let you know in advance, right? So boundaries around how I will and won't show up, where I will and won't show up are so important, because as a Black woman, one of the stereotypes of Black women, and this is based in history, is that Black women are here to serve white people. And so no matter how much I give, right, I did the Instagram challenge, I did the workbook, I've written the book, I do videos, I do classes, no matter how much I give, for unexamined white supremacy, it's not enough. Give us more, do more, do more, and do it for free. So I have to know what my own limits are, and then I have to hold them. Like, I have to hold that internal boundary about how I will and won't show up, and I have to let people know externally, this is a boundary for me. So that one is huge. The other is that I really, part of my, like, we all have anti-racism work to do. Part of my anti-racism work is to prioritize joy and pleasure and love and all of these like yummy things that white supremacy says that I'm not supposed to have.
And everybody has different idea of self-care, like other than going to spas and stuff. I watch reality TV. I watched 90 Day Fiancé. I finished all the seasons, Laila. And it's a trashy show, but I enjoy it.
Yeah, I do love a good Netflix series. I will say that. Actually, when we finish here, my husband and I are, and this is not, it's not a juicy, trashy show, but we're going to start watching the Malcolm X documentary on Netflix. But I've watched, what was that? What was that show recently that I watched, that series? And it was just trashy TV. I was like, it's entertaining to me. But for me personally, actually, books are self-care for me. And you would think, right, as a writer, like I would, and words are my work, that I would want to break from that. But books are actually where I find deep, deep self-care in stories. When it's self-care, then it's memoir style or like poetry or like essays, but that the kind of essays that are kind of like Black feminist writers. So Audre Lorde is you know, one of my loves. And I find reading her essays just really fill me up. I also really love watching, at the moment I'm watching the, what is it called? Oprah's Vision Tour, where she was doing talks with like Michelle Obama and Gayle King and Dwayne Johnson, because I get inspiration from that. And that fills me up as well.
Laila, what is your idea of feminism?
That's a good question. So I think feminism in the mainstream, what we understand it is it's concerned only with gender, and therefore it usually it's prioritizing white women, because white women are not seen as racial. White is not seen as a race. The rest of us are races, but white is seen as neutral, is seen as the standard, it's seen as what being just a person is. And so feminism is about gender. So where I get my where I get filled up from is Black feminism and womanism from Black women, the feminist writings and teachings of Black women writers. That's filling for me because those writers talk about the experience of being Black and woman simultaneously.
But do you think you can add another layer of being Muslim? Because when I look at my feminism, I include my religious identity as well, because that has informed so much of what I do and how people view me.
And that's something that, you know, because I have all of these to-be-read books, like definitely the writings of Muslim feminists is something that I definitely want to explore more.
So you're a podcaster and you've been hosting Good Ancestor podcast for over a year now. So as a podcaster, as a fellow podcaster, what role do you think we have in facilitating conversations like these?
I mean, I love podcasting. Like I love it the same as writing and I love writing. I think podcasts are a way to teach, inspire, and activate. And I think, and you know, different podcasters will host their podcasts in different ways, right? But this conversational style of interview style with different people, I have found, like, I don't call myself an activism, but if there was one way in which I think I do activism is through the podcast, because I make it a point to mainly interview Black and brown people, largely Black women, because oftentimes we are not held up as the leaders. We're not platformed in the same way. Our magic, our expertise is just not public in the same way on these mainstream platforms. And so I've made it like my mission, like I will interview as many Black and brown people as I can, because I want to change that narrative that we're not experts, that we're not credible. And I also want to be able to connect other people with these incredible people that I get to interview.
And in the end, do you have a personal philosophy in the way you ask questions?
I don't have a personal... Well, that's not true. I do. And that's to follow my curiosity. So my process for podcasting is I only ask two set questions. I frame the interview with an opening question and a closing question. That is the same for every guest. The opening question is, who are some of the ancestors, living or transitioned, familial or societal, who've influenced you on your journey? And then the closing question is, what does it mean to you to be a good ancestor? And then the middle part, the meat. So what I do for each guest is I go on a deep dive for each guest. I consume their books, their videos, their blogs, their social media, everything that I can get my hands on. And I like take a college course in that person, basically. Everything they've ever taught or said, I want to learn about it. And then from that place, I enter into the conversation from a place of deep trust that the conversation will go where it needs to go, and my only job is to follow my own curiosity.
That's a wonderful philosophy, and I think many podcasters like yourself try to do that. As I'm having this conversation with you, it builds on what we are talking about and what we are saying to each other.
You know, because the people who I interview have often been interviewed already by so many people. And I don't want to recreate the same thing again. I want first of all, the guest to be asked a question they've never been asked before, right? To feel like, oh, this person really sees me and is with me and is made a connection for me that I didn't even realize about my life. And I want the listeners to feel like, oh, I never thought about it from that perspective. Or, oh, that relates to this thing that happened to me in my life. And so the philosophy, like, I trust God will lead, as long as I've done the preparation work, right? That's my part to do. I do the preparation work and I follow my curiosity, but then I trust that God will lead the conversation where it's supposed to go, and whatever it is, it's complete.
Before we end the interview, where can people find your book? Where can they find your podcast?
Sure thing. So you can find me, first of all, at leilafsaad.com. You can find my book anywhere that books are sold. It's available as a hardcover book, Kindle, and an audiobook. If you want some links for different places where you can buy it, you can check out meandwhitesupremacybook.com, but truly any bookshop is stocking it. And then the podcast is Good Ancestor Podcast, and you can also find it on all platforms. So Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, Podbean, wherever you listen to podcasts, and also YouTube, because it's video and audio. So you can also find it on YouTube.
Thank you, Leila. This was wonderful.
Thank you so much.
I hope you guys enjoyed Leila's episode as much as I did interviewing her. She is a brilliant writer. And to tell you the truth, I discovered so much about myself, my personality, my privilege in some ways through her book. And I highly recommend it to everyone. If you haven't read it yet, please order it. It is the best thing you can do for yourself. Also, if you want more information about our future guests, our current guests, our past episodes, our Patreon, blog, and everything else, you can check our website, immigrantlypod.com. Until next time, stay safe and stay distant.